Today on Future Tense, four interesting European projects that are all about energy and the environment, and which you've probably never heard about. We'll start with transport, both on the water and in the air. We'll hear about a new pilot project to manufacture steel without the use of fossil fuels, and we'll talk with the head of a project called Stockholm Data Parks. It's about reusing the excess heat from data storage farms to warm the Swedish capital. Hello and welcome to the show. Anthony Fennell here. The inland waterways of Europe aren't just picturesque, they represent a major and essential transport network. Later this year, the diesel-driven barges ploughing the waters between the ports of Antwerp, Amsterdam and Rotterdam will have to make way for a fleet of new, fully electric, battery-powered vessels. The first are due to launch in August, and they've been developed by a Dutch company called Portliner, which has spent the past 3 years perfecting their battery technology. Lars van Meegen is the company's head.
You have to look at it like this. In a normal ship, you have diesel engines, and we just take the diesel engines out and we put electromotors in. And then we have a huge cable to the battery packs, and those battery packs have an inverter in them. So it goes from AC to DC, and then the DC powers the electromotor. So that's pretty much how it goes. So it's not rocket science, but you have to have the best suppliers to have the best product.
And the first five barges that are due to be launched later this year, how large are they and how many containers can they carry?
They are 52 meters by 670, and they can carry 18 containers or 425 tons of bulk, like sand, stones or whatever. So they're multifunctional in their use.
Now, these barges will be used in the Netherlands and Belgium, where there are many canals and inland rivers. What sort of reach can one of these have? How far can one travel before it needs to be recharged?
Well, you know, the larger ships, they have four battery packs, but you can put as much battery packs in as you want, but you'll lose cargo space. So the four batteries we have installed now, the four containers with batteries, we call them power boxes, e-power boxes, and they are outside of the loading zone, outside of the cargo area. But if we want to, we can put some in the cargo area and we can travel even further. But that's not really what we're looking at right now. With the four batteries we have outside the cargo area, we can travel 35 hours for the large ships, so the 110 meters. And for the small ships, we have one battery container outside of the loading space and we can sail around 15 hours.
Now, traditionally, the barges that operate in that part of the world have used diesel engines. What's the cost difference between running electric barges as opposed to the traditional diesel barges?
It's the same, fully the same. So what we do is we don't fit any diesel engines, so electromotors are a lot cheaper. We don't have that much maintenance. We don't have clutches. We don't have rudders. We don't have any type of real big investments in the powertrain of the ship. So that's where we kind of take a lower investment in our ship, and we can pull it on another end to get the exploitation the same as the diesel engines. The only thing is that if we go to a terminal and they take the containers out, then the containers have to go to another company and they will use trucks. So what we did with GVT, Group of Logistics, they ordered the new Tesla semis just for putting the chain in a really zero emission way. So we know we are zero emission with trucks as well.
My understanding is that these are to be crewless. There won't be a crew involved with these barges. Is that correct?
Yeah. But only and not for the first five or seven years, because the law isn't allowing us to sail crewless yet. But we will be putting the technology in them.
Now, Portliner is well ahead with their technology, but they aren't the only ones working to rid the world's waterways of diesel pollution. There are other companies in Europe and China with a similar ambition. But Lars van Meegen welcomes the competition.
Yeah, of course, and that's great to see a competitor, or not really a competitor, but to see other people looking into it as well, because we can't do it all alone. You know, there are some 7,000 ships in Holland and Belgium. So if we want to bring all of those ships into zero emission, we need help from others. So it's great to see a different kind of companies looking into the electric transport of barges. Yeah.
And is it possible for the existing barges that run on diesel, is it possible for them to be retrofitted? I presume it would be.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we also offer a retrofit package that takes out the diesel engines and puts in electro motors, and we supply them with batteries and stuff. So that's all in our range of products. I think it's great for us to, of course, build in the Netherlands as a whole, because you see a lot of ships being built in Romania and stuff. So we want to keep it as much as Holland as we can. So we work with Dutch suppliers. We work with Dutch transport companies. Of course, the sustainable effect of our barges as well, because we are truly zero emission. So it's the final step, pretty much. Not hybrid, not diesel electric, just zero emission straight away. So we see a lot of benefits. And of course, with our German friends, they have a lot of noise complaints about the ships. And of course, diesel engines, they really, really loud. So electromotors aren't that loud at all. So that's another benefit as well.
And just very finally, could I get you just to describe the ships to us? I mean, if I was standing next to a canal and one is coming past, what would it look like in comparison to a standard barge?
Well, of course, you would see a futuristic design as well, because we want to build the ships for the future. So pretty much we try to get with Omega Architects the futuristic design we go for, and you'll pretty much see a completely different ship than you'll see sailing past right now. We have a different wheelhouse. So in the normal ships, you see the wheelhouse goes up on a pole, and we use an arm to control it. So that's one of the differences. And pretty much the design is a bit sharper than the normal ships right now.
Lars van Meegen from Portliner in the Netherlands. Up into the clouds now.
Electric propulsion, Siemens and Airbus, that actually started with some first discussions back in like 2010. And we then started together to fly a first hybrid electric motor glider at 30 kilowatt in 2011-2013. And then it became obvious for both companies that there is a big potential in hybrid electric propulsion, potentially even for regional aircraft. What we demonstrate today...
The bilateral agreement that resulted from those trials is now expected to see Airbus and the German company Siemens launch a small hybrid electric plane by 2020, carrying up to 6 passengers. They also have plans for a much larger version by 2030, one that could carry between 50 and 100 people. Dr. Frank Anton heads up the joint project, which is called eAircraft, and he believes the new propulsion system they're developing could reduce the use of jet fuel on a standard flight by up to 20%. I asked Dr. Anton what advantage he sees in adopting a hybrid approach.
Obviously, electric machines are very efficient, and they don't have an efficiency of 100%, of course, but they are close to it. So 95% is typical for electric machinery. But there is another reason. In flying, you have two phases, one in which you use a lot of power, which is takeoff and then climbing up to the flight level. In this phase, you really need full power, whereas during the whole flight, you only need a reduced amount of power for flying horizontally. And this is why the hybrid electric concept is so powerful, because you have this additional power for the high power phase from the battery, but then thereafter, the battery, so to say, is empty. You are at flight level, and now the smaller turbine, which is generating the electric power during the flight, is sufficient. And that is why hybrid electric can save so much fuel and emission.
There are companies, other companies, looking at the development of electric planes. How competitive is the market, and what do you think gives your project a competitive edge?
Well, Siemens and Airbus are actually leading in this field, but you rightly say there are others coming up. We are very proud that together with the Rolls-Royce, which also have now entered into hybrid electric propulsion, we are putting one of our engines into an experimental plane. This is the EFEN-X. So this is a project which comes on top of the Airbus-Siemens collaboration, where then Airbus, Siemens and Rolls-Royce are taking a four-turbine plane, removing one turbine and replacing this one turbine by one electric powerful motor, and so to speak have the first prototype for what will be the propulsion system of a 50-seater later. All over the world, there are many companies now starting to develop hybrid electric propulsion systems, actually. So the market or the competitive environment is now starting up, and everybody is realizing that this is the future.
It is still a big ask, though, isn't it? Because the costs, at least at the moment, for aircraft that that run on standard fuel with standard combustion engines, the cost of running those is still going to be significantly cheaper than electrical power into the future, isn't it?
Well, obviously the target has to be that we can get the same cost for a passenger mile on a hybrid electric aircraft. And we are reducing not only the fuel cost, but we are also increasing the operationability of the plane, because the planes, the electric planes, hybrid electric planes can be much less noisy, which means that you can operate them during times of the day, very early in the morning, very late at night, where you normally would forbid operation of noisy aircraft. And that increases the time span in which you can use your investment, in which you can use your plane. And that makes your business plan for an operator of an aircraft much better.
Now, it's obvious that there are environmental benefits from this kind of flight, but are there environmental concerns over the use and development of batteries? We know that lithium batteries in the past, there have been questions raised about the disposal of lithium and indeed the sourcing of lithium.
That is true, but on the other hand, the good thing about the batteries is, and especially about the big ones, where you always get hold of once they have to be disposed, you can regain all the lithium which is in the battery and use it for the next generation battery.
Would a passenger taking an electric flight, would they notice a difference in the look or styling of the plane, or indeed in the function of the plane?
They would take off from smaller airfields with shorter runways, which may be closer to cities, because as I said, there is not so much noise. And so the physical footprint, but also the noise footprint of the airfield being smaller, it can be closer to the cities. And this would be the advantage that the passenger would immediately recognize. And the educated passenger would then also see that there are propulsive elements at the aircraft, at points at the aircraft where they could not be mounted before. But this will be only for those who really know how aircraft are built.
Battery weight is the big problem. It reduces the range and efficiency of electric aircraft. For that reason, Dr. Anton doubts we'll see a large, totally electric plane flying anytime soon, only the sorts of hybrid models his unit are currently developing. But he does believe there's already a potential market for smaller battery-powered aircraft.
For example, and this is specifically true for Australia, where you have many islands, and if you want to go short distance to such an island and transport, let's say, 15 people in an airplane over a distance of 20 minutes or so to an island and going back and doing this fully emission-free, then this is a beautiful niche for a purely battery electric plane. However, for those distances where you want to travel for 3 hours, the weight of a battery compared to the energy stored in the battery will still be too high for the next decades.
You're with Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. If you have a story suggestion, or if you just want to get in touch about an episode of the show you've heard, then send me a tweet. My Twitter handle is at Anthony J. Fennell. Always happy to chat. Two Swedish projects now that I thought you'd be interested in. The first is called Stockholm Data Parks.
Well, Stockholm Data Parks is a infrastructure in offering to the data center market or the data center investors that want to build a data center in Sweden, take benefit of all what we can offer here when it comes to cheap power prices, but also, and maybe foremost, in our offering, it's about the heat recovery. We pay for the data center excess heat and use it to heat the city of Stockholm.
That's Eric Rylander, and he's the head of data center cooling and heat recovery at the company Stockholm Exergi. Now, this may come as a surprise, but the world's data centers generate an enormous amount of heat, as Eric explains.
As a matter of fact, the global data center industry today consumes about 3% of the total produced electrical power in the world. So they consume a lot of electrical power, and all that power turns into heat when the servers run. So basically, all the power that the data center consumes escapes at the other end as waste heat if you don't take care of it, and that's what we try to do in Stockholm.
And that's the important thing, that this heat is already being generated. There's no way of getting around that if you want data centres. But at the moment, most data centres just let it go, as you say. It is just wasted heat.
It is. And it's not strange, because the temperature level at which this heat is released is not very high. It's maybe like, in a modern data centre, I would say 30 degrees Celsius, which is a little too low for being used directly, in large scale at least, for heat recovery and heating apartments. But what we do is that we use heat pumps to raise the temperature level of this waste heat, and in that way we can make use of it in the residential sector.
So take us through the actual process. How do you actually capture this heat and then reuse it?
The heat recovery scheme really is based on the district heating system that we have in Stockholm. District heating is a way of heating the city based on centralized heat production, really, in big heat plants. But this system is huge, so it connects like 95% of the buildings in Stockholm, 2,800 kilometers of piping underground transporting hot water from the heat plants to the residential areas and offices. And we tap the data center heat into this system, quite simply. So we connect the data centers directly to the district heating system using heat pumps to raise the temperature level of the waste heat that is generated in the data center. And in that way, this heat energy can be used in a district heating system and hence for heating the residential areas.
And this district heating system that you're talking about is a traditional heating system that involves hot water being pumped through pipes to houses in the city.
Yes. This is quite common in the Northern Europe, and especially in the Nordics, where we have quite a big heating demand throughout the year. The average yearly temperature in Stockholm is about 10 degrees. So we have a big need for heating basically most part of the year, not in the summer, but 9 months at least per year we have a need for heating. And through the system, you also generate the hot tap water that you need in your house. So this is a complete heating solution for most buildings in Stockholm.
There are other centres, aren't there, that do a similar thing, trying to harvest that waste heat from data storage centres. But yours is unique in terms of the sheer scale of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that's the big thing, because normally it's really hard to find someone who can use the enormous amounts of heat that is generated in a modern data centre. A fairly small data centre still generates a lot of heat. So in order to take care of all that heat, you need a big system and a big amount of users to connect to the data center. And that's what we have in Stockholm. So our district heating system has a yearly heat sink of 12 terawatt hours, which is a very big number and it's hard to relate to, but a fairly big data center, a data center that has cooling need of like 10 megawatts, will be able to heat as much as 20,000 modern residential flats yearly. So we are talking about big amounts of energy, and you need lots of consumers in order to really take care of all of it. And that's what we can do in Stockholm thanks to the district heating system that is so well built out.
And given that, as you say, there is a similar type of heating system in many cities in Northern Europe and in North America, I understand, do you see what you're doing there in Sweden as, you know, in some ways a role model for those other centres?
Yeah, I would say we were the first to start with this, and we are seeing it being copied in other cities now. Still, our district heating is one of the biggest in the world, so the conditions here in Stockholm are actually better than in most places to do this. And also, what I think is a very important component to this is that we have a business model that we use where we pay for the heat so that the data center actually gets an extra revenue stream from this. So it's not only, you know, making something to contribute to the environment and being sustainable, it's also about good business. So a data center that sells a heat load to us on 1 megawatt on a yearly basis will actually be paid $200,000 per year for that heat that they normally would just waste.
Erik Rylander, and he was speaking there about the Stockholm Data Parks project. Another massive user of energy is the steel manufacturing industry. Steel is essential for modern life, but the way we've been making it to date has been anything but environmentally friendly. Just ask Morten Gernerup.
If you look on a global perspective, the CO2 emissions from the steelmaking industry is up to 7%. And also, as of today, we produce roughly 1.4 billion tons of steel. This is expected to increase significantly in the next coming years or decades because of the development of rising economies like India and Africa. And this means that also the CO2 emissions will pick up. So even if we are increasing the ratio of recycled material in the steel production, there will still be a race, according to the World Steel Association, of the virgin steel, that is the steel produced from iron ore, with approximately 25% at year 2050. This means that the CO2 emissions will follow. They will also increase by 25% from this industry.
So what to do? Morten is the CEO of a Swedish company and project called Hybrid. It's working to change the way steel is produced to make the whole process CO2 emission free.
The Hybrid initiative is based on using hydrogen as the main reductant for reducing the iron ore and producing direct reduce iron. This iron is then in the next step melted in an electric arc furnace. The hydrogen is produced by using fossil-free electricity. And by doing this, you actually decouple the energy and reductant from the CO2 emissions. And you also have no need to use the coking coal, which is the main source of the CO2 emissions of the traditional steelmaking route.
You won't be buying Hybrid's fossil-free steel anytime soon, but the project has now passed the concept stage.
The feasibility study was just closed the week before last week, and we have now been given the go-ahead to start the initial stages of planning for a pilot plant. That will mean that we will start looking at the possibility to establish a pilot plant in the northern region of Sweden, in the town of Luleå and the iron ore fields. And the plan is to see if we can set up pilot facilities for fossil-free pellet production, hydrogen-based DRI production, and the subsequent melting of that DRI in an electric arc furnace. We will also take a look at the hydrogen production to feed the DRI plant.
So you'll start building a pilot plant, I think you said, next year, is that correct?
Plan is that we are now doing a second pre-feasibility study just directed towards the pilot activities, and that will be mainly performed now during this spring. Given that we get a go-ahead, we will then start to do some excavations, and our aim is then to have the pilot facilities up and running early 2020.
This steelmaking process emits ordinary water instead of carbon dioxide. No one has earlier tested using hydrogen in this way in an industrial environment.
And this is part of a bigger initiative, isn't it? Sweden-wide initiative to try and reduce the country's fossil fuel output quite significantly, isn't it?
Yes, that is correct. The Swedish government has decided to become a nation that is fossil-free by the year 2045. And as a consequence, the companies SSAB, which operates in steel, LKAB, which is an iron ore producer, and Vattenfall, which is an energy provider, has teamed up in this hybrid initiative to make sure that Sweden can live up to this target.
This will be a fossil-free steel production plant, but are there any environmental impacts from this new type of technology, from using hydrogen in this process?
I would say no. The hydrogen is produced using electricity, and in the northern part of Sweden, we have an abundance of fossil-free energy and electricity produced mainly from wind and hydropower. There will be no emissions or environmental impact, I would say, of any significance in the energy energy production. And in the steel production itself, it will more or less only emit the water vapor, which you also can recycle.
Is it correct that this is a first, that this is the only pilot plant under consideration in the world at the moment?
Using this specific technology where you have hydrogen as the reductant and using a shaft furnace, I would say yes. Reduction of iron ore using hydrogen is not a new principle, but doing it at this stage and also connecting the whole value chain is world's first, I would say.
Because that's important, isn't it? That this has to be done at industrial scale for it to have any significant impact on fossil fuel emissions.
That is correct. If we succeed, we will diminish the more or less the total CO2 emissions of the iron and ore production in Sweden, which represents approximately 10% of the nation's emissions. And if we also extend the project into Finland, our neighboring country, which is a place where one of our partners, SSAB, has facilities, we will reduce their emissions by 7%.
I've seen in the material that's been put out about this particular project that the cost of doing this will mean that the steel produced will be 20 to 30% more expensive initially. How do you factor that in, or how is the project factoring that cost in terms of making it economically viable into the long-term future?
That is correct. We have done a sort of a benchmark of today's prices, studying what would be the case if we start today with greenfield plants, going the traditional blast furnace route or doing the hybrid route. And as you say, we see that producing a steel slab will be approximately 20-30% more expensive as of today. Our prognosis for the shifts in costs of electricity, the fossil-free electricity, and also the costs for coke and coal makes this anyway a promising economic case.
Now, we're talking here about steel production, but if this project is successful, is there an expectation that using hydrogen in this way could be used for other industries?
Yes, that is our hopes. I mean, I'm, of course, a metallurgist by trade and work mainly within the steelmaking field, but we believe that if we succeed in doing large-scale hydrogen production based on water electrolysis, there will be several spin-offs rising along the way. I couldn't tell today what that would be, but we're quite certain that there will be other areas where you could use the hydrogen.
What sort of interest have you had from other countries or other energy producers in this idea?
So far, we have mainly seen this as a national initiative, but we are also looking into the possibilities to widen this now into Finland, as I mentioned. Also, being part of the European Union, we have ongoing discussions with the European Commission and other companies within Europe mainly.
CO2 emission-free steel, recycled data centre heat, hybrid electric planes and battery-powered barges. It's easy to feel down about the future at times, but as we've heard today, there are lots of clever, environmentally friendly initiatives out there. Thanks to co-producer Karen Savanovitz and sound engineer Dave White. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.